The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. On today's show, we'll speak with John Flansburgh of the rock band They Might Be Giants. The band has a four-decade career of alternative rock hits that also includes several albums written to entertain and educate kids. John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants, next on The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm your host, Lucas Willard. Formed in 1982, rock band They Might Be Giants has crafted hits about birdhouses, worms that are getting pretty good at the drums, and the changing name of an ancient city. The band has also cut several albums written to entertain and educate kids. In July, the band, comprised of core members John Flansburgh and John Linnell, has scheduled shows in the Northeast and California. I caught up with John Flansburgh about the band's four-decade history. Don't let's start. This is the worst part. To believe for all the world that you are my precious little girl. But don't let's start.
It seems like a mistake, you know. I mean, I've had conversations with friends, like, whether or not bands should stay together for 5 years, let alone 40. But, you know, it's been a really wild ride. It's kind of, our lives have really flown by. So we sort of got caught unexpected.
Is it easier to keep a band together when it's really the core is two people?
I suspect it is. You know, and I think it's also, the dynamic between us is really strong. I think there's, you know, I don't want to say like, it is very much a collaboration, but we're, you know, we're individuals and we have different ideas. And I think we both are ambitious for the band and that has, I think that's kind of kept quality control really high.
And I think that, I don't know if I don't want to generalize things too much, but there's not a lot of bands who have been around for 41 years and have consistently released albums since then.
Well, right.
I mean, throughout the entire time of the band, really.
Yeah, no rehab, no early retirement, you know, just car accidents.
So tell me what's going on in the 2023 tour here. Are you playing new material? Any new albums in the works right now?
Well, we just finished up all these shows, and now we're doing a couple of summertime shows, you know, a festival show in New York City, in Pleasantville in Westchester, and Connecticut and Massachusetts, and then we're playing the Hollywood Bowl. We're actually opening for Sparks at the Hollywood Bowl, which is, for people in LA, is like a, you know, it's this ultimate summertime thing. Like when people really get misty eyed when you tell them you're playing at the Hollywood Bowl out there. We have some overseas stuff, English tour and Australian tour, and we're working on recordings, but we don't have any big ambitious touring plans or new plans. One thing that's nice though is we did so many of these flood shows this spring that we've really expanded the format of the band. We've got a three-piece horn section with us, and it's really incorporated into the show in this really, in a bunch of interesting, very musical ways. And it's just kind of expanded. I mean, it's really a new, in many ways, it's a totally new show for us.
Talking about the flood shows, Flood came out in 1990.
Yeah.
I want to think.
Yeah.
And a lot of the songs on Flood, that was kind of a big hit for you guys, that album.
It certainly was, yeah.
How did that album change from going from a small-time band that started in the early 80s and then working, and then having this big break, really at the peak of this college rock alternative radio snapshot in time, I guess, this period of the late 80s, early 90s? You know, did that album just sort of spread organically, and did it take you by surprise?
Well, it was sort of the culmination of everything taking us. It was sort of like there was like I think there was like a 5 year continuous surprise run between like 86 and 91. Like everything was everything kept on changing. We're the kind of band that like plays at the bar down the street, and people come out and go, they're really different, and maybe they never make a record, or maybe they have one song that's like a breakthrough song. But like, we did not assume that we would have a career at all, I don't think, from the beginning. And so when we ended up on a major label and sort of having that Saturn V booster rocket of promotion lashed to us, that was a bit of a, that was a bit of an adjustment. But there had been so many adjustments, and we had to sort of graduate from playing for crowds of 50 people. We did tons of shows in New York City in the mid 80s. Like every weekend we would play and play for very small crowds, and we got very used to doing very rehearsed, elaborate shows for these very small crowds. And then that just all we kind of graduated to real clubs and theaters in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was, that was a huge adjustment, just sort of mentally, like to feel like, you can perform on a stage in front of 2,000 people and communicate anything at all. It's like, I mean, you've got everyone's attention, and the lights are all pointed at you. You've got microphones, and you need to, say something. But it's like, I think it's hard. It's hard not to have a little bit of imposter syndrome in, I mean, nobody's, I guess some people are born natural performers, but I don't think either John or I were. And so that was something that we had to kind of, grow into.
Probably the first They Might Be Giants song that I heard, a song from Flood, was Particle Man.
Particle Man, Particle Man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle Man, is he a dot or is he a speck?
Sure.
Because it was on Tiny Toons.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to, I'm 35, so I was young when that came out. It was on reruns all the time. And there's the video with all the cartoons running around and everything else.
Yeah, well, I mean, that show, they only made a few episodes, and then it just kind of cycled for years. And that was so it was sort of our lucky break to be in on the first group of animated things that they did. It sounds really cynical to say it, but we were on a van tour when the offer came over the transom. And I mean, I don't think, I mean, like a lot of things in life, there can be sort of two things happening at the same time. And our very first sort of blush of real mainstream success in 1990 with Flood, it was also, we had never been broker. I mean, we had never had less money. Like when we were doing our first couple of albums, we had day jobs, and we had good day jobs, and lived in, we were like, sort of risk averse people. And all of a sudden, like we're, we've kind of given up on, we're just joining the circus and sleeping on the floor of the van. And when the offer came in, it was like for, I don't know what it was for, like thousands of dollars. And it was like, yeah, we'll do that. And that was my, for a long time, that was my main thinking about it, was like, that was a really good payday. And ultimately there, I we found there are a ton of people in the world, there are a ton of people at our shows to this day, like you are probably, your experience is actually essentially the common experience of the front row of our crowds now.
The Tiny Toons fans.
Yes, they're all like, I first heard them on Tiny Toons. Yes.
But you guys had all of these songs that did end up in cartoons and are still in cartoons with Mickey Mouse and the songs for Disney.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So with that first inclusion in Tiny Toons, did that light a fire and say, okay, the paycheck is nice, but we can do things with an animated cartoon. We can write songs. Did you have an intention to write songs that would make good cartoons? Or did
Well,
you naturally have songs that were, a little offbeat and were sort of enhanced by a cartoon?
I mean, I think we grew up with Bugs Bunny and grew up with cartoons, very much in that sort of TV generation of kids. I think we have a healthy regard for cartoons. And it's fun to see stuff realized that way. I mean, we've done a lot of kids stuff, and a lot of the kids stuff we've done has we've collaborated with animators of all sorts of different kinds. And there's kind of been a boom in animation in the past 20 years or so, that people can do stuff with After Effects and do stuff at home, and it's just like there's a lot of creativity in that world. So it's just an interesting thing. I mean, I wouldn't say I think all music works with animation really well. I think they're like, it's a Reese's peanut butter cup of medium.
In a future time, children will work together to build a giant cyborg. Robot parade, robot parade. Wave the flags that the robots made.
So you have released a number of children's albums. There was No, there was Here Come the ABCs, and then the 1-2-3s. When you decided to release that first children's album, No, was there a moment in your life that really inspired you and John to write that? Or did you say, hey, we've been writing these albums that kind of have a mix of more traditional-ish kind of rock and roll lyrics and then a couple of really more silly ones?
I think it seemed like it would be an interesting vacation from doing albums. We had been on a major label for 10 years, and we were suddenly free to do work with anybody. And we ended up doing incidental music and like the opening theme for The Daily Show. The theme was written by Bob Mould from Husker Du, but we did all that sort of horn driven thing that you hear on The Daily Show that was us. And we did the theme for Malcolm in the Middle. We were doing advertising stuff and incidental music for TV. John had a little kid, and we didn't really want to be on the road too much. So it was like an easy way, taking on these sort of outside jobs was an easy way to stay home. And the offer just came over the transom from Rounder Records, which was like a very idealistic, interesting, a record company that we knew about from growing up in Boston. They were like originally a New England based company. And they were like, we're doing kids records. If you're free to do it, do one. And it really seemed like it would be like a vacation from having to think about rock critics and having to think about commercial radio and having to think about all the things that you think about when you're having like a regular kind of pop music career. And it was a really interesting sort of writing assignment. Writing for kids is, it sort of strips you of all the things that of all the kind of preconceived ways you think of writing. And that was an interesting challenge. So we did it, and we also kind of did it in the free time. We were working under crazy deadlines for Malcolm in the Middle. Like the show went from being sort of in production to being on the air and being the number one show on Fox. So everybody was calling us up and yelling at us about this or that for months and months of our lives. So at the end of those recording session days, doing songs for the kids record was like our sort of our personal work after, when you, like it's 5 o'clock and everybody can go home, but some people stay behind and do a little bit of their personal work. That, working in art departments in publishing, like that, to me, that's a very common memory. And you always know, like, people are really more into their personal work, so we would sort of hang back at the studio and just work, put together another song for the kids record. Oh, that's good. That's fun. And the spirit of sort of freedom, I think, is really in that first record. You can tell that, like, we're really enjoying ourselves. And then when it came out, it was like insanely successful. That was the thing. Like, we thought we were making, essentially like a Christmas record or a Halloween record or something that was just going to be an incidental thing. And all of a sudden it was as big as the rest of our career that we had been, working on for a decade or more. So, it was just one of many, many surprises. Like, you just don't know how things are going to land. What's that expression? There's like in Hollywood, there's some expression that's like, nobody knows anything. And I feel like that really, I feel like I've learned that over and over again.
If you weren't a rock star, would you be a teacher?
I've done shows for kids, and I can tell you that teachers are vastly underpaid. Because kids are a really tough audience. I think I'd be a graphic designer. That would be my goal.
Meet James Ansar, Belgium's famous painter. Dig him up and shake his hand. Appreciate the man. Before there were junk stores.
One of your songs, Meet James Ansar, mm-hmm. sticks in my head as an earlier one, but one that is kind of a history lesson, and you're talking about a specific artist, and I can't help but draw the comparisons to Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. They did songs like Vincent van Gogh.
Right.
And No One Was Like Vermeer, other songs about
right.
painters.
Well, and I mean, I guess that Pablo Picasso was their first song that, you know, I mean, you know, we grew up in sort of the same neighborhood that Jonathan Richman is from, like the western suburbs of Boston. So he actually played at local high schools in the early 70s when I was a kid. And so his music was more of it, probably more available to us than anyone anywhere else. He's just a great, great songwriter and definitely inspiring. But you know, the original song that kind of kicked it off for us was actually written by it was on another New England label, and it was on a kids label, this song Wide as the Sunshine, which is also people the working title would be like The Sun is a Mass of Incandescent Gas.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees.
Which we started playing in our show almost as like camp, because like if you were an adult, you grew up with this certain kind of vitamin infused children's music that was like, you know, this song is good for you. And there was something very like over the top about this song, because it's just this information stuffed song. And that's like a format that as soon as we sort of discovered it, it just seemed like a really fun way to write a song. And I guess like, I'm trying to think, our friend Matthew Hill and John put together this song, James K. Polk, that was pretty much straight out of like an encyclopedia entry and had all this information about James K. Polk, except for the fact it's really value neutral. Like James K. Polk was a terrible person, but he was president of the United States. Something that, you know, we can all think about. Then once that sort of format was introduced, I just drafted in behind it with me, James Ansar.
So along those lines, then, with these wordy scientific songs like the sun is a mass of incandescent gas and all that,
yeah,
is that something that bounces right off kids? That when you're finding you've kept up this educational kind of streak in writing kids songs for a while, do those wordy science based songs really not grab kids like you think they did? You said that vitamin infused kind of edutainment.
Well, it's a really good question. I think if you do, you know, when we did Know, the first kids record, our goal was to just not to have it be informative at all. Like it was not to improve kids at all. We were actually sort of went in the exact opposite direction, and it was just be like, let's make a record that's fun for kids to listen to. You know, the truth is that like, once we actually entered the kids' world in earnest, the educational stuff was just a great way to frame a record, and it was sort of just a trampoline we could jump on to write a whole bunch of songs. And you know, writing songs about language is really easy, but it's for a slightly older age group. I mean, the final kids record we did with Disney was about science, and that, you know, definitely was for, you know, 8, 9, 10 year olds, because you just have to have a really different vocabulary.
Life is made out of cells. Cells make copies of themselves. And they make copies of themselves.
How has YouTube changed the course for the band? And, you know, you hear about iPad kids.
Not enough. Oh, yeah. Well, you know what's interesting is that before COVID, people would always come to our shows. You know, all our shows are for adults. I should just, like, you know, reiterate, because I know people are thinking, like, oh, I guess these guys are doing kids stuff. But our shows are not oriented towards kids at all. But there was this thing with adults where they would come to shows with these gigantic iPads and just be videoing the show with this screen up above their heads for, you know, for minutes and minutes on end, if not the entire show. And it was a trend that just kind of came and went. And maybe it's because there's more bags are checked more, and maybe they don't let you bring them in now, but, like, we don't see them anymore. But there was a period where it was like, it looked like some kind of weird alien press conference with all these iPads hoisted above people's heads. It's a trend I'm glad has gone away. Well, you know, much like moshing, it was interesting while it was happening, but I'm glad it's over.
Were there mosh pits at They Might Be Giants shows at one point in time?
In 19, I can tell you, we were playing a show at the Newport Music Hall in Columbus, Ohio, in the spring of 1991, and people started moshing very early on in the show, and for 3 years straight, every show had a mosh pit formed, or just going full on. And then there was the sort of the ritual passing of the dude, you know, who would get summarily, like, dumped on the front of the stage, and then the security guy would have to push the guy off the stage. And it was just like this weird rock theater. Grunge, just, it didn't matter what song, you know, we could be doing the quietest song in the show and people would be moshing. It was just like this, it was just a moment.
So grunge came to you.
Grunge came to us.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned Sparks earlier. You guys are now, around 60? How old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
Oh, I'm 62.
So you're 62.
Oh, no, I'm 63.
So, you know, you've had this long career, and some of these artists who I think some might lump in the same kind of category as a little offbeat, unusual rock bands, like,
sure,
Sparks being one of the front runners. You know, have you had the chance to meet all of your early influences and or work with them?
Well, you know, I saw Sparks when I was 15 years old in Boston at the Orpheum Theater. And, you know, I shook Russell Mayall's hand then, but I haven't seen him since. You know, it's interesting to see somebody like an act like that get so much recognition so far along in their career, because, you know, in many ways, they've struggled. I mean, they much, much more than most acts. You know, they were on every label imaginable, just, you know, tried a lot of different things. I mean, they were like a dance hall act for a while. Yeah, I've met a lot of people. I've met Elvis Costello a number of times now, which was really a thrill. And yeah, I mean, you know, you definitely get to have show business friends.
So do you have younger artists who are also coming up to you and saying, you inspired us to, you know, kind of do our own thing, stay the course? Have you gotten those kinds of compliments from younger artists?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to, like, you know, sound self-aggrandizing. I mean, I don't want to reveal that I want to be self-aggrandizing. No, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, this thing happens to me. It happened a lot, especially when we had, like, videos on MTV, but it happens on a pretty regular basis. If I go into, like, a music store, I will often get, you know, recognized by somebody in the store who just culturally would seem very far away from They Might Be Giants, as you just wouldn't think, like, this guy is a They Might Be Giants fan. It's like, this guy, you know, it's like, they'll clearly be, like, a rockabilly fan, or like a heavy metal fan, or, you know, they'll just be, like, into some, you know, music subculture that's much more understood. And they'll just say like, hey, you know, I know your band, you guys, like, it's really cool that you guys like kind of like broke through. Like, I, you know, you guys are, it's great. And it's, and the impression I get is that even if they're not our biggest fans, I think there's something, people find it inspiring for a band that's maybe not so genre defined to have made it into some kind of more mainstream acceptance. I think that, you know, they recognize that like something about They Might Be Giants is legitimate. And that's very flattering to me. And I always appreciate those kinds of compliments, because it's like the culture, a lot of times you just, I think especially musicians feel like the culture is very closed off to anything that is singular or anything that is really original, and everything is all about sort of some shade of copying or just like a permutation of some mainstream stuff. And it's just nice. We never assumed that like we wouldn't fail. You know, it just seemed like very clear to us that there were kind of governors on our success. Like we're not the prettiest people in the world. We're not the greatest performers in the world. And our material is kind of strange. So it's like those are huge things that stop people from getting super successful. And yet, you know, we've endured, and that's happened for a bunch of different reasons, but it's nice to be, it's nice that people know that like it, you know, good things can happen to a band like us.
That's John Flansburgh of rock band They Might Be Giants, which is hitting the road in the Northeast and California in July. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard.
You can hear Indiana by the light switch. Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul. I have a secret to tell.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1709. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.